brief break to get the computer set up. We'd actually gone through slides 1, 2, and 3, and so in the interest of moving things along, if you could go ahead and put slide number 4 up on the screen there. It's a slide that is the second slide in a series that you have entitled Replication. And go ahead and pick up your testimony there and explain what's going on with this slide, please.
Well, this slide talks specifically about the fact that this is a relatively unique group of viruses that contains its own RNA transcriptase, which is used to generate the messenger RNA, which then becomes protein. The RNA transcriptase is also packaged into the infectious virus particle at the end of the process when new virus progeny are formed. And it talks about how the positive strand RNA serves as a template to generate more negative strand RNA to be packaged into the virus particles that can then infect additional cells.
And what just flashed on the screen so we can have the court reporter keep up with it here is page 5 of exhibit number 4.
So this is page 5. And it talks again about replication as the process occurs, as protein is being made from the measles virus RNA. It talks about specifics and the importance of the protein. So the M protein is necessary for assembly and for the virus to be released from the infectious cell. The F protein, and we'll hear a lot about the F gene and F protein, is responsible for fusion of the virus envelope in the host cell membrane following attachment. And the M protein is the nucleoprotein, and it functions also in virus replication and is involved in encapsulating the genome RNA. So it kind of forms the first shell of the virus that protects the RNA.
And the fact that you have several slides up there describing replication, what's the significance of replication, just very briefly at this point, in Colton Snyder's case?
With measles virus, replication occurs in a very orderly fashion from the left side of the genome to the right side of the genome. And we had talked about this before, that it's so orderly that proteins are produced in a specific order. And the F gene is one of the genes that's late in order. So if the F gene RNA is detected, the other RNAs have been produced, suggesting that the replication process is ongoing and that RNA is being made and then protein can be made. So it's an orderly process.
And is this an orderly process that can be detected through laboratory testing?
Yes, it can.
Okay, and we'll talk about that in more detail as we go through your testimony, but I just wanted to make it clear to the special master why replication at this point is significant in the case. So let's go ahead and look at slide number 6 to exhibit 4. This is a slide that's called types, and if you could describe what's going on with this.
Well, the measles virus belongs to a group of viruses, which is called morbilliviruses. And morbilliviruses are very host cell specific and host specific. So they infect only certain hosts and not others. And the diseases they produce are somewhat similar depending on the host that it infects. So for instance, in the morbillivirus group is the canine distemper virus. It's a virus that infects dogs, fox, minx, wolves, and it is associated with a neurologic disorder. If we go down to the poussin and dolphin morbilliviruses, which infect seals and dolphins and porpoises respectively, this is, again, a virus that causes neurologic manifestations. Rinderpest virus, on the other hand, which is also in the same group, which infects cattle, African buffaloes, and yaks, and was a major problem in Africa, results in death as a result of infecting the gut and causing symptoms associated with the gut. It is not a neurotropic morbillivirus, whereas measles virus, canine distemper, and the poussin and dolphin morbilliviruses are.
And what is the significance of the neurological involvement of these types of viruses in the same family to this case?
The fact that there are viruses which are closely related but different in host specificity that can cause neurologic disorders and can be isolated from the brains of infected animals.
Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the next page, which would be page number 7 to exhibit number 4.
And essentially I'll talk a little bit about diagnosis, because diagnosing measles oftentimes does not require any laboratory or elaborate tests. It has very specific manifestations that are well known. So oftentimes measles virus is easily diagnosed by certain clinical features, such as fever, a particular type of rash, something called Koplik spots, which occurs in the buccal oral mucosa, and there are other symptoms that are associated with measles virus that are very characteristic with the infection process.
And so then it looks as if we continue on to page 8, there's an additional discussion about the diagnosis and presentation of measles, is that right?
Yeah, so this is essentially a child with Koplik spots. And this slide was taken before the laws were in effect, so we don't have to blind his eyes. It appears about 2 days after the prodromal syndrome starts, and it's commonly associated with those white nodules you can see on the buccal mucosa underneath the tongue, and it lasts for 1 to 2 days. This is very characteristic of measles and measles virus infection.
So let's go on to page 9 then, Dr. Kennedy. It looks as if we're moving away from clinical or symptomatic manifestations of measles virus into some laboratory issues. Is that correct?
Unless we want to look at the next slide, which shows Koplik spots a little...
We're still on slide 8.
Slide 8, yes.
The bottom. Okay. And that's the teeth and tongue.
The tongue with the white spots.
And then now we're on page 9. Sorry about jumping the gun on the last photo there. But it does look, from this slide, as if we're moving from a discussion about clinical presentation to laboratory diagnostic work with MV infections.
And again, diagnosis of measles virus infection can also occur in the laboratory. And there are two major methods that are used, serology and antibody detection. And those methods have been referred to as ELISA, hemagglutination inhibition and neutralization. And direct detection of the virus, either through cell culture and virus isolation, antigen detection, and you'll hear about PCR, in this case for measles virus, reverse transcriptase, or RT-PCR.
Let's go ahead and move on to page 10 then. And what are you seeking to describe in slide 10 to exhibit number 4?
Well, I think at issue here is the persistence of measles virus and how does measles virus persist in a host. And there are a number of different viruses and virus groups that cause persistent infection. Some you're very familiar with, others not so familiar with. And my point here is that we really do not understand the mechanisms of viral persistence for a lot of the viruses. For DNA viruses in the papillomavirus group, an example is the human papillomavirus, which has been associated with cervical cancer. It's probably one of the better studied viruses from a standpoint of persistence and how it maintains itself in a state that prevents it from being destroyed by the immune system. In some individuals, that persistence will result in cervical carcinoma. In other individuals that are infected, they will remain healthy and be quite fine. for decades without any symptoms, any symptomology, any indication of infection other than detecting it by very sensitive techniques such as PCR. And the same with the RNA viruses. So retroviruses include things like human immunodeficiency virus and a neurotropic virus called HTLV-1, which has been associated with adult T-cell leukemia. And in this situation, these viruses can persist. The mechanism of persistence is better known than a lot of viruses because their replication cycle requires a stage where they ingrate into the host genome. But for instance, with HTLV-1, in a subset of individuals, it will cause a neurologic disorder that's called TSP, or tropical spastic paraparesis. And I'll give you the spelling for that. So if you're latently infected with HTLV-1 and it persists, in some individuals, they can get TSP. In other individuals, they'll get adult T-cell leukemia. In other individuals, they'll be fine for 30 to 40 years. So mechanisms of persistence are not well known.
And this issue of persistence and replication, that's significant in Colton Snyder's case because it's your testimony that the vaccine strain measles virus was replicating in his system and therefore persisting in his system long after the administration of the MMR vaccine. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so the concepts of persistence and replication are critical to understanding the presence of measles virus in Colton Snyder's body several years after his immunization. Is that fair?
Correct.
So let's go ahead and move on to the next slide, which I believe is number 11 in Exhibit 4.
Okay. And I showed this slide before in the Cedillo testimony, but I thought it was still relevant here, and that how can virus persist in a host when they have a functioning immune system? And the easiest way for viruses to persist is in an individual that's immunodeficient or dysfunctional. And I give examples of immunodeficiency or immunodysfunction in individuals that can either be caused by primary or inherited defects. And for instance, 1 in 500 individuals in the United States have what's called a common variable immunodeficiency. And the most common variable immunodeficiency is a selective IgA deficiency. There's also immunodeficiency or immune dysfunction that can be acquired. Infection of the immune system is an example of acquired immunodeficiency. HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, which causes AIDS, is an example. HTLV-1, which I just mentioned, causes adult T-cell leukemia and TSP. Measles virus, chronic malaria are examples of immunodeficiency or immunodysfunction that is acquired. Also things like heavy metal exposure, malnutrition, cancer, age. When we're young, we don't have a competent immune system. And when we get old, our immune system wanes, so it can result in an immunodeficiency or an immune dysregulation.
And if you recall from the presentation of the evidence in the Cedillo case, do you remember the testimony of Drs. Vasisposhian and Vera Byers?
Yes.
And do you recall those two expert witnesses, both in their testimony and report, describing in the Cedillo case the immune suppressive effect of mercury contained in pediatric vaccines? Do you remember that testimony?
I remember reading and hearing about it, yes.
And so you're not here to offer testimony as a heavy metal toxicologist. But you would be relying on the testimony of those experts in Cedillo to identify opportunities for immune suppression in Colton Snyder. Is that correct?
Yes, I would only give testimony on heavy metal bands.
Indeed. So aside from heavy metal bands and relying on Dr. Sasposian and Dr. Byers, you also do talk about measles virus as an agent, so to speak, of immune suppression. I know we're going to get into the summary of your expert report in just a moment, but while we're on this slide, is it going to be your testimony that the measles virus immune suppressive effect was a factor in Colton Snyder's presentation here?
I would certainly say that's more likely than not.
And when you say more likely than not, that's to a reasonable degree of scientific probability?
Correct.
Okay, let's move on then into the summary of your expert report. And this is slide 12 to petitioner's exhibit number 4. And I'll just ask you to, as we said early on, this is not to regurgitate the entire report, but distill it to bullet points. And I'm going to ask Dr. Kennedy to walk through some of these and interrupt with some questions as we go so that we can move through this efficiently. So Dr. Kennedy, if you could start off with a summary of the report that you submitted in this case.
Okay, so measles virus and closely related viruses in the same subfamily and genus are neurotropic and can cause neurologic disorders and sequelae in humans and other species that they infect.
And I'm going to do my first interruption. What do you mean by neurotropic?
They infect cells of the central nervous system.
Go ahead.
Measles virus and other morbillo viruses can cause persistent infection and have been detected in cerebrospinal fluid, CSF, and the brain of individuals that exhibit neurologic disorders.
And when you say persistence, that's the process that you were referring to earlier in the slides, which is the continued presence of the virus in the body without destroying the host cells.
Correct.
Okay. And then you have a final point on page 12.
Measles virus infection and replication requires the presence of measles virus RNA.
And the measles virus RNA is, again, what you described in the very distilled version of the formation and the replication of the measles virus in your slides. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's go ahead and keep moving through the summary. We're now at page 13 to exhibit 4. Tell us a little bit about the immune dysfunction here.
Immune dysfunction is a term that encompasses problems associated with the normal function of the immune response. Viruses in general do not persist in a host because the host has an effective immune response. Viruses in general persist in a host because of an ineffective immune response.
So in other words, if the host has a fully functional and healthy immune system, the viruses that are introduced would simply not persist. They would be eliminated from the body.
In general.
And by not persisting, that means they wouldn't be in the body replicating, correct?
Correct.
So this really talks about there's no persistence and there's no replication in a body that has an effective immune response. Is that right?
For most viruses in general. There are examples where that's not the case.
Would it be your testimony that any of those examples are going to be relevant for the case here?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll go on to slide 14 then, to exhibit 4.
Okay, again, there are a number of contraindications for administering the MMR vaccine, which are described in the physician's desk reference. Adverse events involving the MMR vaccine have included neurologic disorders. Studies in immune dysfunctional children have shown measles virus replication based on the detection of measles virus RNA by PCR up to 60 days after clinical symptoms. Presence of measles virus RNA at multiple sites indicates an ineffective clearance and the potential for persistence.
Now, in describing some of these, the studies and the adverse events, I know that in your expert reports in Cedillo and in this matter, you included bibliographies and citations. Is that correct?
Correct.
And your testimony in the summary is based on the citations and the references contained in the materials already on file in this matter. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's go ahead and move then to slide 15 in Exhibit 4.
Okay. The laboratory of Dr. John J. O'Leary and his colleague Dr. Orla Shields at Trinity College in Dublin is highly competent and skilled at performing molecular-based techniques and molecular-based diagnoses.
And why is it significant in this case that Dr. O'Leary and his colleague are competent and skilled in doing the lab work we're going to talk about in detail?
Because this is the group that diagnosed the measles virus RNA in Colton Snyder's CSF.
Continue.
In particular, Dr. O'Leary continues to receive prestigious awards and honors for his work in the area of molecular-based diagnoses, including the St. Luke's Medical Chair, which is St. Luke's Medal, which was given to him by the Royal Academy of Medicine, and an endowed chair in pathology at Trinity College.
And as far as you know, Dr. O'Leary continues to conduct PCR work, is that correct?
Correct.
Continues to publish that work, is that correct?
That's correct.
And the work that he publishes is in peer-reviewed scientific journals, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Now, the last point in your slide describes PCR. If you could just tell us what you're talking about in this summary.
So, PCR is a standard technique to demonstrate measles virus persistence. And it's an established technique used by a number of investigators in the field.
Okay. And at this point, would you like to explain to the special master, in summary, what PCR involves?
Okay. So, in this case, PCR, our RT-PCR, reverse transcriptase PCR, involves the detection of measles virus RNA in biological fluids. It's a standard practice. The differences that can occur are based on primer probe pairs. We've heard in the past some concern about the techniques, contamination issues, primer design issues, probe design, false positive issues, and a number of other issues that are technical challenges to developing PCR methodology. And a competent laboratory can recognize these issues and resolve these issues very rapidly.
And we'll talk about that resolution of some of those issues in a moment, but let's then move on to slide 16.
The detection of measles virus RNA, the high levels of measles virus RNA detected in CSF samples of Colton Snyder at a time point when an effective MMR vaccine-induced immune response should have cleared the measles virus indicates that measles virus RNA has amplified as a result of replication and persists in part of his body where it is not expected to be found.
And go ahead and continue. I'm going to have some questions getting back to the whole slide, but I want you to go through it first, please.
Okay. The detection of measles virus RNA in the CSF supports evidence of viral persistence in the CNS and the brain. And then similar to other neurotropic morbillary viruses, the presence of viral persistence in the CNS and brain will result in neurologic disorders and manifestations.
And the opinion that's summarized here on this slide, is this an opinion that you hold to a reasonable degree of scientific probability?
I do.
I want to talk about high levels of measles virus RNA. What do you mean by high levels? Is that equivalent to high count?
No, it's inverse relationship.
Okay, so let me explain.
So the high levels found in Colton Snyder were 3.7 times 10 to the 4th copies per nanogram of RNA. And in studies that have been published using PCR, using real-time PCR, if you look at a lot of the figures in different papers, where they start showing quantitation is 100 copies and above. So 100 copies oftentimes is the baseline used in figures of numerous papers. So this is well above that 100 count, and I would consider anything above 1,000 relatively certain high positive.
And Is it significant that the count you're looking at is in cerebrospinal fluid?
Yes, I would not expect to find anything in cerebrospinal fluid.
And when you say you would not expect to find anything, that is, you would not expect to find, a few years after immunization, you wouldn't expect to find any measles RNA in the cerebrospinal fluid. Is that correct?
No, I wouldn't.
And so now we're not only seeing a little or none, we're seeing a lot. Is that correct?
Correct.
What is the significance of that high level to you, informing your opinion in this case?
I think that that high level is gives me a high level of confidence that what they're detecting is measles virus that shouldn't be where it is.
And not just measles virus, but measles virus that would have come from the vaccine strain contained in the attenuated MMR immunization, is that right?
Correct.
Now, evidence of replication and persistence, you've talked about the RNA and the PCR techniques that pick up the presence of RNA. That's been, in summary, what you've discussed as proof of the viral persistence, correct?
Correct.
In addition to the presence of RNA as evidence of persistence and replication, what other evidence might you look for and a laboratory look for to determine whether a virus is persisting and replicating in a system?
The presence of the virus at multiple sites, the presence of different genes from the virus, different gene products, the presence of protein from the virus, all these to me would be indication that replication had occurred.
And when you say the presence of proteins, are you familiar with literature that describes the presence of proteins as part of proof of replication of a virus?
Yes, there's numerous publications in the literature. For RNA viruses, an example would be Syndes virus.
I'm sorry, Syndes?
Syndes, S-I-N-D-B-I-S, Syndes virus.
Okay.
That clearly shows the detection of protein and the presence of RT-PCR positive gene products in infected cells.
So it's not just the RNA, because that, while it sounds like strong evidence, you now have combined the production of proteins.
Right.
And these are proteins that can be identified in the case of measles virus in that orderly strain. Is that correct?
Correct.
So at some point, if you detect not just the RNA, but actual protein products, at a certain point in the chain where those products are produced, you know that all the preceding products were being produced also, correct?
Correct. And if I could show my first slide in my appendix, it's a slide that you've seen before, but it gives an example of the orderly replication that I was talking about.
And this would actually be slide 18. Slide 17 is the cover sheet for the appendix. So we're at page 18 of exhibit 4. So Dr. Kennedy, go ahead and tell us what's going on in this.
And actually the special managers have seen this slide before. And it just shows the order of the measles virus genes as they're involved in replication, the production of more messenger RNA, and the production of protein. And the genes of interest are the F, the H, and the N. So the N is the first being produced. More N gene products should be produced, sorry, and more.
And more, can you hear me? Is this good?
Move it back just a little bit.
Just a little bit. Sort of put some middle ground there.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay. And let me sit back. And the N should be the most abundant gene product and also should be the most protein that one can detect in an infected cell where replication has occurred. So if you detect the F gene, the N gene, the P gene, and the M gene should also have been produced. And if you detect the H, then F, M, P, and N should also be produced.
And it sounds from your earlier testimony, not only should they be produced, but given the orderly replication process that goes on with measles virus, as a matter of necessity, they would have been produced. Is that
yes.
correct? Okay. And the idea that every preceding gene in the sequence is a necessary precursor to the final one, that's well established in your field of expertise, isn't it?
Correct.
So any testing then that would identify an F gene, for example, in a tissue sample would necessarily mean that N, P, and M had been produced sequentially before the F, correct?
Correct.
Why is that significant in Colton Snyder's case?
Because the F gene was detected.
And who detected the F gene?
It was Unigenetics, the laboratory of Dr. O'Leary.
And this is using the reverse transcription PCR technology that you talked about.
Correct.
And in my layperson's understanding, there are three processes that go on in PCR involving solution, TACMAN, and in-cell. Is that correct?
Correct. In situ.
In situ. Thank you. I never take a chance at Latin without knowing how to say it. So those three are all designed to identify the RNA. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, you also mentioned the persistence and the presence of proteins. What is the process by which the proteins are identified?
A classic mechanism is immunohistochemistry.
And when you say a classic mechanism, immunohistochemistry is something that is fairly standard procedure in labs that use PCR to identify proteins. Is that correct?
Correct.
And in fact, that was a procedure that the O'Leary lab used. Is that correct?
Correct.
It's also a procedure that the authors in the Ullman paper that has been discussed at length in the Cedillo matter, that immunohistochemistry was used in the results that generated the Ullman paper, correct?
Correct.
So in the Ullman paper and in Colton Snyder's case, is it fair to say that there is evidence through PCR and immunohistochemistry, both of measles virus RNA and measles virus proteins?
As I testified in the Cedillo case, that the detection of the N protein, which is described in the discussion of the Ullman paper, clearly indicates that replication had occurred and the infected cells or infected samples being examined were well on the way of producing additional virus particles.
And then the immunohistochemistry that's cited in the Ullman paper essentially confirms the findings of the three RNA methods. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Just want to make sure that's a fair way to describe the analytical approach to the laboratory results. Now, you were here yesterday. Seems like longer ago, but you were here yesterday, I believe, and have seen, in any case, what's been labeled as the respondents' Exhibit AA. That was a letter from Dr. Oldstone to Dr. Ward that was filed in this case. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. That letter describes some dispute between apparently Dr. O'Leary and Dr. Oldstone about samples that Dr. Oldstone sent to Dr. O'Leary's lab for testing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Are you familiar, through personal knowledge, outside of what you saw in that letter, are you familiar with the facts surrounding that dispute between the Oldstone and O'Leary laboratories about sampling?
Yes, it was a very major part of the discussion that we had during during a visit to the UK with Orla Shields.
And let's put a little bit of context on it. When you said a visit to the UK with Orla Shields, I know we talked about this in the Cedillo matter, but as briefly as you can you just give us some context to describe the setting where this meeting with Dr. Orla Shields came up? In fact, Orla Shields is a colleague of Dr. O'Leary's.
Correct.
And Orla Shields worked with Dr. O'Leary in his Unigenetics lab doing the PCR work.
Correct.
And she's one of the authors on the publications that the O'Leary lab's work ultimately was used in.
Correct.
So when we're talking about Drs. O'Leary and Dr. Shields, these are two folks working together in the same place on many of the same projects, correct?
Yes.
Using the same technology?
Yes.
Using the same facilities?
Yes.
And using the same facilities that produced the data for the Ullman paper, as well as the lab results in Colton Snyder's case?
Yes.
Okay. Just so folks have a clear idea of sort of who the players are are here. So go ahead then with that given and describe to the extent that you can the interaction between these two labs that are at issue in the letter we've just seen filed.
I was asked by a former colleague, John Marchalonis, if I'd be interested in attending a meeting that dealt with measles virus adverse events and the immunology and virology associated with it. And it was going to be held in the United Kingdom, and I said, sure. The meeting turned out to be a meeting of the expert witnesses at the time that were being put together by Alexander Harris based on some litigation that was ongoing in the UK. And I went over and attended the meeting, had a good amount of time with Dr. Shields and a number of other respected virologist individuals that I didn't know personally but knew by reputation through publication, etc. And Dr. Shields presented the data that was being generated by the O'Leary lab, and there was a lot of discussion and a lot of grilling, criticism, clarification, convincing, and discussion of how the O'Leary lab was doing their measles virus RT-PCR.
And in the course of those discussions, did this issue that Dr. Oldstone and Dr. O'Leary's lab had disagreements about some of the findings on samples from Dr. Oldstone's lab, did that come up?
Yes. At the time, Dr. Oldstone was developing a transgenic mouse model that contained the CD46 human host cell receptor for measles virus and was looking to develop a better mousetrap, per se, to examine aspects related to measles virus replication, more mimicking the human situation.
And so Dr. Oldstone's lab then was handling a significant amount of measles virus material at that time, is that correct?
Correct.
And as part of the work that Dr. Oldstone was engaged in, apparently from the letter that we've seen filed, he sent samples that he believed to be negative to Dr. O'Leary's lab, correct?
Correct.
Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Tell us what you know about that, please.
Well, there was discussion on the inability to replicate certain measles virus detection in tissues from these transgenic animals that have been inoculated by various means with measles virus, either orally or intracardiac or intraperitoneal. And the argument led a number of us to say that, you know, maybe this is issues related to low detection, that you've got such low copy numbers you can't detect it, or a situation where something's coming up positive that should be negative. Is there contamination? Tell us about the contamination issue. And we discussed in detail the possibility of contamination, the way the O'Leary lab and Unigenetics handled the material gave at least myself and a few others at the meeting confidence that the contamination source was not the O'Leary lab, because they were not dealing with actively replicating measles virus. So they had either samples from SSPE individuals, or they were using plasmids as controls that they had, which just contained partial sequences of measles virus.
So it sounds like the dispute here is that material from Dr. Oldstone's lab that he presumed to be negative for measles virus, some portion of those samples, when sent to Dr. O'Leary's lab and were tested, actually tested positive. Is that the dispute?
Yeah.
And what you're saying is that you have a high degree of confidence that any potential contamination that might have generated a false, or not a false positive, but contamination that might have occurred, You're confident it was not at Dr. O'Leary's lab, correct?
I believe they actually resolved that because Dr. Oldstone sent additional samples and that those samples, when sent again, turned out to be negative. So there was some discordance between samples being sent, what was positive. It was clear that contamination had occurred. And, you know, with contamination, it's who contaminated it. You know, did it come from the source, or did the source who was doing the assay contaminate it?
Right.
I think the point that we were looking at was, if it got contaminated, how could the O'Leary lab have contaminated it? And the other thing is that we felt it really wasn't a big issue because it was identified as contamination and it was easily fixed and rectified.
And fixed and rectified at the O'Leary lab end of things, correct? Yeah,
correct.
So it's entirely possible then that the reason the O'Leary lab was getting some positive low count results on samples from Dr. Oldstone's lab is that those samples from Dr. Oldstone's lab, in fact, were not negative. Is that a possibility?
That's a possibility.
And if they were not negative, that would be a result of contamination in Dr. Oldstone's lab, correct?
Correct.
And it's entirely possible, based on what you saw and what you had experience with, that possible contamination at Dr. Oldstone's lab actually could be the reason that the O'Leary folks were finding positives in purportedly negative material.
Correct. But it was also my understanding that they were working through the issues and that, indeed, they had figured out what the issue was. It was contamination. One wasn't blaming the other, and it had been resolved.
And you also mentioned that the issue of contamination seemed to come up based on copy numbers or count.
I think the issue was that no one had any problem with high copy numbers. So if the sample had high copy numbers, there was not an issue. It was this low copy number window of, you know, is it positive, is it negative, that was really part of the issue and level of discussion.
And when you say there wasn't an issue involving high copy numbers, is it accurate to say that what you mean by that is that the Unigenetics lab and the Oldstone lab analytically agreed on positives and on positives when they were high copies?
At the time, I was not sure that the Oldstone lab was doing RT-PCR. They were doing more classical viral isolation techniques, and they wanted to look at very sensitive techniques to see if they could find measles virus replication in tissues where you wouldn't anticipate it would be in a mouse that was transgenic for the measles virus cell receptor. So that's why the collaboration, my understanding, between Oldstone and O'Leary occurred initially. But the issue had always been low copy numbers.
And your impression, again, is that when it was high copy numbers, there was really no disagreement between the two laboratories, and the results were equivalent at the high copy numbers.
No, and they had some of the tissues from the Oldstone transgenic mice had smoking numbers of high copies in the types of organs that they were examining.
And the results on those type of tissue samples would have been equivalent between the two laboratories when they did their testing?
I'm not sure, again, if Oldstone was doing RT-PCR at the time for direct comparison, but certainly if he isolated virus through tissue culture means, you would anticipate that there's a good amount of virus there.
And high copy numbers we've talked about for a few minutes, why do you think that the high copy number issue, that is, these two laboratories that seem to be in conflict based on this letter, it sounds like the two laboratories were actually in agreement on high copy samples. Why is that significant in Colton Snyder's case, the case that we're here about?
Because Colton Snyder has high copy numbers of measles virus RNA.
Great. I want to get off of that topic for just a moment and get you back into the presentation here and ask if there's anything else that you feel you need to talk about on page 18 that describes replication of measles virus.
No, I think that the special masters have seen that slide and probably have it better memorized than I do.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and move on to the next page, which would be...
And actually, those were just examples if the respondents had questions from a standpoint of... I was anticipating some questions that might occur from a standpoint of PCR contamination, how you might rectify it. And the other one was just the course of how measles virus infects various human tissues.
Yeah, and that would be slide 19. So let's just take a quick look at slide 19.
Okay.
This is the one that's called measles virus pathogenesis. And understanding you have it prepared primarily to help guide folks through any issues on CROSS, let's go ahead and just quickly summarize what you're showing on this page.
So from a standpoint of infection, the infection with measles virus normally occurs through the respiratory tract, then goes to lymph nodes, gets into the blood, and causes viremia, which is a presence of measles virus in the blood, to the reticular endothelial system, then causes a second viremia, and this is also associated with the clinical symptoms, the fever, the rashes, and then from the second viremia, it can go to various places like the central nervous system, the GI tract, blood vessels, urinary tract, respiratory tract, conjunctiva, the eyes, and these are all associated with a lot of the clinical symptoms that one can see during measles virus infection, particularly when it's not controlled well.
And understanding that you're not a clinician and a neurologist, there will be other discussion from other folks about what happens in this pathogenesis when the central nervous system and the GI tract are involved. So I think we'll just leave it at that and move on to the final slide, because this talks about PCR contamination, and I would like you to address the contamination issue a little bit, because a moment ago you described in your work over in the various meetings and the conversations you were privy to in the UK, issues about testing for resolving contamination issues where they could either be anticipated or actually happened.
Contamination issues with PCR happen all the time in all the laboratories. And the point is to recognize contamination rapidly and fix it rapidly. And how do you recognize contamination? You recognize contamination by running the appropriate controls. And what I show here is an example of a contamination that happened in my laboratory. It's not with measles virus, it's with simian virus 40 large tumor antigen, which is an issue that we're dealing with, finding it in places where it shouldn't be and issues of persistence where it shouldn't persist. And in this instance, we're looking at mesothelioma biopsies from individuals that had mesothelioma, and there's a hypothesis that along with asbestos, SV40 may play a role. So if you take a look at panel A, this is an issue where we had obvious contamination. What do I mean by obvious contamination? If you look at lane 2 and you look at lane 10, lane 10 is our positive control. You see that very bright band on lane 10? Lane 2 is our negative control. It's one of the negative controls that contains no template. So with no template in there, there should be no amplification by the primers, and you shouldn't see a band. We see a band. Now you look in lane 3, another control, that's just a water. So we don't see anything there. But what we do see is if you look in lane 7 and you look in lane 9 is baboon kidney cells, and baboons are notorious for being harboring simian viruses. You can see a positive for 9 and you can see a weak positive for 7, the mesothelioma sample. So that data would tell us that, yes, SV40 plays a role in some, can be detected in some mesothelioma samples.
and that would be fine, except our negative control was positive. So what did we do? Well, we had a normal process on how we fixed this. And the first process is to change the water. Blame it on the water. And if you take a look at the panel B, and these are just agarose gels, the lane designations are the same, but you see in panel 10, the positive control is positive. 2, 3, and 4 lanes, which are our negative controls, are all negative. You don't see any band. And the baboon kidney cells and the four mesothelioma samples, 5, 6, 7, and 8, are all negative. And it took us about 8 hours to rectify that particular contamination. We've had others where the primers have been contaminated, where we got contaminated primers from other individuals, where we've had laboratory contamination ourselves. It is something that you have to be very diligent about. And anybody who's competent at doing this type of molecular diagnosis has the appropriate controls to know when contamination occurs. And contamination does occur.
And so it sounds like contamination does occur and is actually expected. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the presence of contamination in and of itself doesn't mean that there's necessarily a problem with the lab, right?
No.
What it means and what you have to really look for then is whether the laboratory has procedures, protocols, and responses in place to deal with the anticipated contamination. Is that right?
Correct.
Based on your knowledge and your experience with the Unigenetics lab, can you describe for the special master your opinion on whether they met the proper standards for recognizing and dealing with contamination?
They were as competent as any laboratory I'd ever seen, and probably more competent because of the issues that they were dealing with. So they took special conditions, had special laboratories, special hoods, special processes, special procedures to prevent issues related to contamination. And at this time, this was specifically for measles virus. These days, it's more for diagnosis of various types of human cancers.
And it should also be clear that at the time that the O'Leary lab was doing this work, not only were they observing the protocols that you just described, they were under scrutiny and had people flying in from all over the world, including yourself, to specifically address these issues of contamination and how to deal with contamination, correct?
I wasn't there so much to deal with the contamination as I was to evaluate the immune response and look at other aspects. It was just that I had some background in molecular biology and some of the technologies that I was asked to sit in on the presentation by Dr. Shields.
Okay. So you were present and that created the confidence based on what you heard that in fact they were doing that and doing it under fairly intense scrutiny, correct?
And I watched all the other individuals who were in the room pretty much feel the same way. Although we did leave still arguing about low copy numbers.
But you left with no argument about high copy numbers.
None whatsoever.
And high copy numbers are the issue in this case with Colton Snyder's CSF findings, right?
Correct.
Now, I believe there's been some both testimony but even argument from the respondent's side that the O'Leary lab's work has never been replicated. Are you familiar with some of those arguments?
Yes.
Do you have an opinion as to whether those arguments are correct as a matter of fact?
There has been some replication of the data. At the meeting I was at, I specifically knew of replication of data relative to high copy number positive in CSF from various individuals in the UK.
And do you recall who any of those UK individuals were?
As far as the specific patient, or
the folks that were doing the work?
Oh, the laboratory doing it. So there was a large discussion about how are you doing the confirmation? You know, how, since you're not
participating with the large cohort that's, you know, doing the direct comparison, how are you confirming this? And Dr. Shields discussed a collaboration with a doctor who, Cotter, C-O-T-T-E-R. And I believe Dr. Cotter at that time was at the Royal Hospital of London, which is associated with the University of, University College of London. Dr. Cotter was also a molecular biologist, PCR expert. Dr. Cotter initially had some problems in replicating the work of O'Leary because of a number of issues related to primers, primer design, sensitivity, etc. And what happened was that they went through the process of getting things to work again, providing, synthesizing new primers, providing the primers lyophilized, so he rehydrated them in his laboratory, and that he was able to reproduce the high copy number. And I believe the reason that the O'Leary Laboratory selected Dr. Cotter was that he was also someone who was interested in pushing the window on detecting low copy numbers.
Okay. And so in the work that Professor Dr. Cotter was doing, he was using the same protocols, the same PCR protocols as the Unigenetics lab.
Yes, the Unigenetics lab provided the primers, they provided the probes, they provided the samples. The only thing that they didn't provide was the isolation kits and didn't provide the water. And water is important with this type of technology. They sent samples from tissues of the transgenic mice infected with measles virus, among other things, and that's how the laboratories got up and in concordance. But it took a lot of effort.
And as they progressed through doing the work, and what I'm talking about, they is Dr. Cotter's laboratory, as they progressed, did they produce results that they could then compare to the O'Leary lab results?
I believe so. During our conversations, we did not see specifically Dr. Cotter's PCR methodology. There was discussion of it. There was discussion of the problems they had. There was discussion of how they rectified it. And there were problems with how they were detecting and how it was comparable. But we did not see the specific hard data.
You didn't see the data. And just to then make it clear, when you talk about the problems they had, you're referring to the difficulties they had in getting the primers that would be efficient enough,
right,
and specific enough to do the PCR testing on the samples.
Correct. So they had to resynthesize the primers and the probes.
And the probes.
Yeah.
And the probes were the ones that would have been used in the TACMAN procedure. Okay. But aside from having to redo the primers and the probes, there weren't any other problems that you're aware of that either of these labs had in doing their, for layperson's terms, a validation study.
Right. And essentially, I do remember them validating high copy numbers in CSF.
And is it your understanding that as copy numbers went up and got higher and higher, the results from the two labs actually converged and became more and more equivalent? Is that fair?
Correct.
Okay. Now, you're talking about things based on your knowledge. As far as you know, has any of what you've just described been reduced to writing anywhere?
Yes, it's in the UK litigation files.
And is there any reason that you're not able to show up here and present those writings to the special master in court?
Yes, because it's my understanding the UK litigation, which is over, is sealed by a court order, so I'm not free to produce any of those documents or documentation I may have.
And you're simply limited to testifying based on your personal knowledge and the facts that became aware to you in the process of working in the UK litigation.
Correct. And sometimes it's hard with all that knowledge not to put your own personal opinion in. But I've tried to keep that aside.
Yeah, and avoiding personal opinion but getting to expert opinion. And so based on everything that you've said here today, would it be your opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific probability that the results in Colton Snyder's case generated by the O'Leary lab are scientifically reliable?
For the cerebrospinal fluid, yes.
And when you say for the cerebrospinal fluid, the cerebrospinal fluid presence of measles virus particularly.
Correct.
And is it your opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific probability that vaccine strain measles virus persisted and replicated in Colton Snyder's body from the time he got his MMR up through the time he had his lumbar puncture taken?
Yes.
And is it your opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that the laboratory work that generated the results that you're basing that conclusion on are trustworthy and reliable?
Yeah, you usually don't give awards and honors to individuals who are less than diligent, I guess would be the term.
There has been, at least in one of respondents' expert reports, the report of Dr. Ward, there's a statement that contamination at the O'Leary lab was more plausible than the it was a more plausible explanation for the finding of measles virus in Colton's CSF than the actual presence of measles virus. What's your reaction to that opinion?
I would say then we should have seen measles virus in the blood sample.
But you didn't.
Didn't.
It's also been said in that report and in other places that the O'Leary labs having that the fact that there might have been contamination in the O'Leary lab at some point invalidates any results and makes the final results of any of the work the laboratory has done unreliable. What's your take on that issue?
Absolutely not. I mean, contamination issues and other issues relative to PCR specificity and sensitivity are dealt with daily. And a laboratory that's competent recognizes it rapidly and can fix it rapidly.
And that goes back to your earlier point, and this is to a reasonable degree of scientific probability, that the O'Leary lab, in fact, could deal with contaminations in a scientifically appropriate way.
Exactly.
And they could do it in a way that would make their ultimate results reliable because they wouldn't be relying on results where they hadn't applied their contamination protocol correct.
Correct.
And that's based on, again, your personal knowledge working with those folks and consulting in the UK.
Correct.
There's also been testimony from the other side in Cedillo and in reports in this case that there's little evidence that vaccine strain measles virus is neurovirulent. What's your opinion on that statement from the respondent's case?
I guess I would argue that that the MMR vaccine contains a attenuated version of measles virus, but it's still capable of replicating, and it's still capable of doing the same sorts of things that the measles virus itself can do, albeit at potentially a lower level. And there was a publication by Weibel in 1998 in Pediatrics that discussed the adverse events reported for the MMR vaccine in for the last, from I believe 71, I probably have my dates wrong, for a 20-year period. And I believe there were 48 cases of individuals that had adverse events, and those adverse events were associated with a neurologic sequelae.
Now, when we talk about neurologic sequelae, another point that's been raised by the respondent side and the folks they're relying on is that the disease model of viral persistence just doesn't fit here, like extrapolating from canine distemper and things like that just isn't applicable. Can you describe for the special master your response to that critique, that basically this, the disease model that you're describing and that Dr. Kinsborn has described just doesn't fit here with the symptoms in this virus.
I would just say that animal models are an important component of any sort of research investigation into pathogenesis, into developing new methodologies for detection, into looking into any aspect, be it vaccine efficacy, vaccine safety, new treatments, etc., and how close the model mimics the human situation is very important. One thing nice about the animal models is that you can do a brain biopsy on a canine distemper infected dog and actually isolate canine distemper virus from the brain biopsy, which is something that's very difficult to do in humans. And I think the important aspect is if you look at the situation with canine distemper, you look at other situations that have been described in the literature, that when you've done brain biopsies, not everybody who had measles virus isolated, not every dog, was dead. So they were harboring the virus. It was causing some issues, but those issues were not fatal at the time. So in 10 years, or dog's life, you know, 10 years in a dog's life, would that become fatal? It very well could. But we know so little about persistence, and we do know that you can have persistence and have mild symptomologies, such as human papillomavirus and things like dysplasia, or you can have very major situations like cervical carcinoma that metastasizes and, you know, results in death. So there are different degrees relative to what persistence can cause, and I think that the animal models suggest that MMR can be neurotropic and can do the types of things that we're seeing in Colton Snyder. Doesn't necessarily mean it does it in all individuals, but in certain situations, I think that it's comparable. And there are studies with in non-human primate models using MMR and using measles virus, and that very closely mimics the human situation.
So it sounds like from what you just said, you would disagree with one of the statements in one of the expert reports that for the morbilliviruses that appear in animals, the appearance of symptoms is virtually an inevitable harbinger of death. You would not agree that that's necessarily the case in those animals or in conditions involving that virus in humans.
I would not agree with that statement, correct.
Well, Dr. Kennedy, we've covered a lot of ground today, and it covers a lot of ground from Cedillo. I'm going to go ahead and be done with my questions now, Special Master. I anticipate respondents going to cross and obviously would have an opportunity to redirect if needed.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Governor?
If you wouldn't mind, ma'am, if we could take our morning break now.
Sounds fine to me. How about we reconvene at 11?
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you.